Welcome back to the program. President Obama came to office promising to close the U.S. military base at Guantanamo, promising to adjudicate the detainees that are there. Neither one of those things have yet happened, and we have found that the issue is far more complex than originally thought. That's what we're going to talk about today with my guest, Commander Glenn Solmassi. He's a judge advocate and an expert in national security law. He's been on the faculty of the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, where he serves as the first permanent military law professor in the school's history. He also served on the faculty of the International Law Department at the U.S. War College and has been an adjunct faculty member at the Roger Williams University of Law since 1999. He's a former National Security and Human Rights Fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and he's the author of a new book entitled The National Security Court System, A Natural Evolution of Justice in an Age of Terror. It's just published by Oxford University Press. Glenn Solmassi, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Jeff. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you here. What has been the overriding problem, the overriding issue when we look at the possibility, the reality of trying to close Guantanamo?
I think legitimacy is an issue as well as political will. I mean, the one item I think most people will agree on, we need to close Guantanamo because rightly or wrongly, intentionally or unintentionally, the facility has been tainted both internationally and domestically as being a place where potentially people are being held indefinitely. There's only been three trials in 7 years, and I think the administration, as you note, came in with good ideas, strong ideas, and went ahead and called for the closure, but there seems to be a lack of political will from the congressional side of the House to actually funding that and supporting that effort. And I do think we have to applaud President Obama and his administration for stopping, sending the signal to the world that we want to close the facility for a variety of reasons. But secondarily, I think his effort to close it within a year is kickstarting the process, and his commissions that he's established have to look at these issues have been really, I think, now conscious of the complexities associated with closing Guantanamo Bay legally and politically require a complex solution, and I think that's what they're struggling with now.
I want to talk about that complexity and the fact that there seems to be this bifurcation, this schizophrenia with respect to how we deal with those detainees either in the federal court system or in the military justice system, and neither really seems to fit the bill.
That's correct. I think the Bush administration was trying to jam a square peg in a round hole, and you had the two paradigms which you eloquently note are using the federal court system and or using the military law system. And those two rigid paradigms, I would have thought, have merged at some point, but the reality is 7 or 8 years later, we're still entrenched in those. And what we need to do is start recognizing sooner than later that this is the complexity is that this isn't really either, isn't appropriate for either. It's really a hybrid war we're fighting. Mm-hmm. It's a hybrid fighter in terms of the al-Qaeda fighter, that they're a mixture of both international criminal and some sort of a warrior. In a war that's a hybrid, a mixture of both, we're using more law enforcement personnel than we have ever before with military operations. We're using police forces, the FBI, CIA, with military operations more than ever before. So it's a hybrid. It seems logical that, Jeff, that we go from a hybrid fighter in a hybrid war, that we would have some sort of a hybrid court system.
Mm-hmm. Why has it been so difficult from a legal perspective, from a policy perspective, to find that middle ground?
I think any time something is new is always difficult. But I think trying to capture the idea that these aren't traditional warriors in the sense we fought before, nor are they like a RICO prosecution or a mafia prosecution or a drug prosecution. They don't fit neatly in either regime. And what I've been saying for years is we did update strategically and tactically to meet this new threat. We created the Department of Homeland Security. We created the Director of National Intelligence. In terms of tactically, we've gone ahead and we've applied the surge in Iraq, and now you're seeing it happen in Afghanistan, new ways of fighting using counterinsurgency warfare. The one area we've been lagging behind really is legally, and I think there is a sense that if we're hearing recent reports, the Obama administration recognizes that there has to be fresh ways and new ways to look at this threat from a legal perspective, and I'm hoping that they continue to do so.
If we look internationally, are there precedents for this kind of a hybrid situation? We take a look at, for example, the troubles in Northern Ireland,
right,
where it was really treated as a law enforcement issue. Can we learn anything from other experiences?
I think it's tremendously important for us to look at our different allies who have explored this, both in Ireland, the failures in some ways of the Diploc courts, where they used a national security court type system. And we can really look to, ironically, is France. France has a tremendous counterterrorism legal structure, a little bit different from ours, where the prosecutor would function as prosecutor and judge. But they have used that to much success, recognizing not necessarily that it's a war, recognizing that it is some sort of a mixture of the two, unique from both military operations and traditional law, that they have national security apparatus for legal prosecutions. And some of these have worked very well, as in France. The legitimacy of the Diploc courts in Ireland as a result of the Troubles certainly had some downsides, and not many people know of those. But we can find the positive aspects of these different countries who have explored these areas. And to some degree, if you look to France, it's been rather successful in France. They've really limited the amount of, deterred the amount of terrorist activity within the nation of France, predominantly as a result of their strong legal system.
Wouldn't the logical step have been to do this within the context of the military justice system?
I do think that. I think up front we have to look initially that throughout history, military commissions have been used since the founding of the country. In a traditional war, those that violate, like Al-Qaeda, violate the laws of war are subject to a military commission within the military justice system. So if we admit, as President Obama has, as well as President Bush, that we're in some sort of an armed conflict, albeit unique, it's important that we do recognize that there has to be some additional way to look at this. If we go back to President Roosevelt, he also used military commissions for the saboteurs in World War II. But the real distinction, I think, Jeff, is that in previous conflicts, when we use military commissions, it's the exception that we prosecute, small numbers. When we fight Al-Qaeda, there's actually every single one of them, by virtue of their activities, not wearing a uniform, indiscriminately attacking civilians, as in toto, they're all unlawful belligerents. They're all illegal belligerents. So we have to kind of switch the presumption here, where in the past it was for a small number, now it's all of them. Where it used to be the exception, now it's the rule. And we have to have some sort of a system to capture not just the 240 that are in Guantanamo Bay now, but also over in Afghanistan. We have thousands more being held in Bagram, Afghanistan, and the inevitable captures in the future. So the numbers are quite daunting.
To what extent has the enhanced interrogation activities that we've engaged in really made it much more difficult to find a solution?
There's no question. Normally we'd be able to. The military justice system is incredibly fair, but it never fit properly, as I was alluding to earlier. It was not geared for this sort of unique fighter. And the enhanced interrogation techniques have certainly caused problems in terms of evidentiary issues. In a traditional war, you hold a POW, you get information from them, and then you hold them until the cessation of hostilities. In this case, there is no, arguably no end to the war, at least for the foreseeable future. So you don't have that option of just holding indefinitely. When you want to try to bring people into a court of law, and you have interrogation techniques that could be viewed by some, or at least argued by a defense counsel, that potentially violated the Convention Against Torture or other areas of our international obligations, like as yesterday was the 60th anniversary of the Geneva Convention, something like that, that it would become terribly difficult to try these, never mind in military courts. Can imagine how difficult, if the pendulum swings too far, trying them in our own federal civilian courts.
What about the actual physical location of these detainees? Because that seems to be a parallel track problem here, not only in terms of how we adjudicate these detainees, but where we put them, if not Guantanamo.
Correct. And, you know, that's part of the political will. We know the Congress, even though President Obama was voted into office knowing that he was going to close Guantanamo, when it came time to vote for funding for the closure, the Congress overwhelmingly in bipartisan fashion rejected any sort of funding for closing, because they would bring the detainees into the United States. I think everywhere in my book, and what I think we have to do, and what President Obama, I think, is trying to do, is accommodate and reach a third way and find accommodations in the middle ground as best we can from those two prevailing paradigms. One of the items that is of concern is bringing detainees into the United States. Certainly there is a lot of people throughout our country, citizens, that are concerned about bringing them into onto U.S. soil. But if we're going to ask other countries to hold detainees, to take them, France, Italy, Ireland, it becomes increasingly difficult for us to pursue diplomatic channels to repatriate these folks if we don't take any into the United States ourselves. So although there's legitimate concern about people, the alleged Al-Qaeda being housed or detained or tried on U.S. soil, we have to look and say, A, we have to from a perception perspective, but secondarily, is there really a threat when we bring people into a high max facility prison? Is there really in a max facility prison, is there really a threat of them escaping? But if there is that perception, the most secure places to put these people are in a military base.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes to the whole idea of a hybrid court system, is that you have civilian judges overseeing this in a national security court system, but on a military base where there is security, prompt, certainly an ability, if there was an unlikely opportunity that someone from Al-Qaeda might attack a military base holding these people, what better place would it be than to have a military base be able to respond to an attack on a military base rather than a civilian entity?
Isn't the argument, though, about security and safety and where these prisoners go, isn't that really a false political argument? Certainly we have people in some of the supermax facilities in this country that are a lot more dangerous than 98% of the Guantanamo detainees.
Jeff, no question. I do think it's a red herring. I think it's unfortunate. We really have to put this behind us and also assume responsibility for what we've done with the detainees. To raise those issues, I think, are unfortunately the problem with the political actors getting involved. What these issues are not Republican, Democrat issues. These are American issues. This is about regaining our identity in the world, our identity within the United States, and sending the right perception that we not only uphold the rule of law, but we can still protect the national security. Saying that these folks are going to break out of prison or create problems for the local communities, I really think that's unnecessarily hyperbolic.
Mm-hmm. Was there any consideration, as far as you can tell, when Guantanamo was initially set up as this current facility that it is,
yes,
as to what might happen in terms of both the legal system and in terms of the physical reality of the detainees being there?
I think initially how that transpired, we have to put ourselves back 2001, 2003. I think President Bush, rightly or wrongly, looked to past precedent, history, and even if you look at in the book, I note the actual executive order from President Roosevelt is almost the same as President Bush's. It's really modeled after the same. So I think initially President Bush's intention was to use a military justice system to be rapid. One of the great hallmarks of military justice is rapid adjudication, rapid trials. And what's happened is, unintentionally, due to a variety of reasons that the book goes into, that we wind up having 7 or 8 years of people not being tried. And it's taken on the mantra of being the gulag of our times, when I don't think that was the intention at all. President Roosevelt, when he ordered the military commissions against the German saboteurs in the Second World War, from the point of capture to their habeas proceedings before the Supreme Court, to their military commission, and to their execution and convictions, was approximately 42 days. So I think it's, looking back then, that was what the president was expecting, additional attacks. The administration was, I think they were trying to find some model to use. And as we said before, the natural inclination would be use a military model and use one that was used by a great progressive like President Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
However, as I said, we've evolved in many other areas in the U.S. government to how we approach, attack, and deal with the threat of Al-Qaeda. And you'll see, strangely, the one area we never really evolved or morphed into was closing Guantanamo and setting up some new system that would be more appropriate, that would reach that appropriate balance between promoting national security and supporting the rule of law.
How important is it that whatever plan evolved from this, that it really have the appropriate international legitimacy?
I think it's the most important issue, Jeff, no question. And not just international, but domestic legitimacy. We really need to have something that does show send a signal to the world that we are following our own guidelines. And one of the items in the court system I propose is it is better than virtually every other system in the world. It's not our Article 3 system with all the constitutional protections, but it's pretty darn close to that. So we send the signal. And one of the areas that we have to be conscious of, one of the great areas to provide legitimacy, is one civilian oversight of the process. Rightly or wrongly, perceptions matter in the 21st century. And having military officers, although we know they're fair, and I clearly think that they're fair, oversee hearings of what appear to be to the world as civilians, in civilian garb in their traditional home clothing, it looks illegitimate. It looks like we're having some sort of a kangaroo court. And I think that's important that we have civilian oversight. And the second item that I think is the most important in terms of legitimacy is trying every detainee. What we can't get into the gamut of thinking about indefinite detention or administrative detention to the cessation of hostilities. That sends the signal that we're not trying people, not providing them habeas hearings, not giving them the rights that normal people would have had in traditional courts. So we have to be able to do that. When I'm overseas, those are the two items that come up when I was speaking in England. Is one is the civilian Article 3 judges, and then the trials. Mm-hmm. We've got to try every one of these. That's the best way to regain legitimacy in the eyes of our allies, is trying every detainee.
What have we learned from the limited trials that have taken place so far?
In the military commissions or in the civilian courts?
In the military commissions.
In the military commissions, I think we, know that they are fair. But I think what we have recognized is when the head of Amnesty International calls Guantanamo the gulag of our times, the difficult part is no matter what they decide at this point, the legitimacy has already been eroded to such a point that they're no longer able to have any sort of respect or standing in our world eyes and in many of our own citizens' eyes. So the trials that we've done to date, the three that have taken place, one being a plea bargain, there's two things. One is that they're tainted irrevocably. And the second is I think many folks get concerned, are we treating differently folks that are from Yemen as compared to maybe our allies that are in Australia or Great Britain? Are we treating those folks with greater rights or greater protections than we would to those who are maybe not as strongly aligned with U.S. interests? And that's a danger as well.
Talk a little bit about the difference between going forward from this point, assuming we could figure out some kind of a national security court system, how we would deal with that as opposed to those that have been there for 6-7 years, and how difficult it might be to make any kind of a transition to a new system.
I think that's a terrific point. What do we do? We've had people there for 8 years. I think what the president's done is tremendous in terms of how he's looking at this. There are some that we can repatriate, and we're trying to do that. We know the United States is trying to repatriate some. We've had some limited success. Folks that have been there that are really not a threat, and also not a threat to the United States or have never committed necessarily a war crime, no indicia of that. Second part is are those that we can try. And I think a new system being set up is important for them to be able to, if they know they're going to be tried and they're going to have a habeas hearing, that sort of a system does help us move along. The real third one that the president's looking at are the 50 to 100, which you referred to earlier, that may have been subject to enhanced interrogation techniques, may have been captured in unusual circumstances, or might, if given the opportunity in a courtroom, make a mockery of a court. And he's struggling with what to do with that. And what I've been advocating strongly is to not fall into the trap of thinking we can detain these people or have a system set up just for preventative detention.
Uh-huh.
The key is the presumption should be try them. If there is that one case or two cases that we think they're so dangerous after the trial's been held that we can't release them, then we can make that exception. But we want to be careful about what our presumptions are. The court system that we create, if it's presumptively adjudicatory, we're able to move these cases forward and basically shut down Guantanamo Bay and try these people. If we get into the trap of saying, well, the 50 to 100 that are so dangerous, what can we do with them? We should just keep them indefinitely. That will erode any support for any new system that we do create.
And that is the paralysis that we seem to be in right now.
Correct.
And that the longer it goes, the more difficult it is to make that transition that we're talking about.
There's no question. And what I call for is kind of both to promote international legitimacy and also to protect the country and promote human rights is to close Guantanamo Bay, bring these detainees to military bases, on military bases, have civilian Article 3 judges, but that are experts in the law of war and intelligence law and have that background, a specific bar, like you do for bankruptcy, immigration, tax. We have those sorts of courts in existence already. And we create that and provide these detainees within 3 months habeas hearings. Everyone would have a habeas are, many of them are people that are dedicated towards attacking the United States and attacking Western interests. So if you have that one-year period where you have a period where intelligence professionals can do their job without extending it beyond what is legal or appropriate, that winds up promoting national security, allowing it. And I think you and I both know, Jeff, 1 year, about that time frame, any valuable intelligence they have is probably gone.
Right.
So keeping them beyond that point is probably a red herring as well.
Is there a danger on the other side that it's setting up this kind of national security court system that it itself could be subject to abuse, a little bit of build it and they will come, that to the extent that we set it up, it then gets clogged with a lot of things that probably shouldn't be there?
Well, I think that's a great point, and one that I regret that I did not spend a lot of time in the book on, and from going around the last couple of months, and particularly I'm working on a project with the World Justice Project on counterterrorism and the rule of law. And talking to people both internationally and domestically, one item that's critical to prevent any sort of potential abuse that you speak of, which I think is a legitimate concern, is a sunset provision. Any legislation that the Congress and the President come up with should be sunsetted within 5 years. That allows us to work the system, see if it's working, if it is accomplishing the goals that we intended, at least initially, that it can close down in 5 years. Or the Congress can reauthorize it for a future if it hasn't been. That'll give a chance through two administrations to prevent any potential abuse that could occur. And that's one of the items that's important as well, is this can't be done just through executive action. It really has to be both of the political branches, the Congress and the President, establishing this court so that you refrain or prevent the potential for any sort of unconstitutional abuse of such a court system.
Right. And to what extent is there oversight of this, and where does that oversight come from? Does it come from the federal courts? Does it come from Congress?
It would come from the federal courts. Of course, the Congress would still, the Judiciary Committee would still be able to have hearings and oversight in their constitutional role. But predominantly, an appeals process within the system would go up to the Supreme Court, so the Article III judges would have that authority as well. There has been some discussion in Washington that I've been privy to about how someone comes into the system. Do they come in? Does it federal district judge, the traditional Article III judge, make the decision whether they go to civilian courts or into this national security court? And I've resisted from that. I think the best way is to have it initially, if we capture somebody or have someone that is alleged to be al-Qaeda, it goes right to the national security court system, where the national security court judges hold the habeas hearing, and from there we can make a decision on where to go. But that's probably the best way to go about it, is having the checks from the Congress, the Judiciary Committees in both the House and the Senate, as well as having ultimate appeals to the Supreme Court.
And what is your sense, finally, of the reality of moving this forward, of moving some kind of a system like this forward?
Well, I've been very encouraged by one, and I think we all should be, that the administration's been open to all ideas. I think there's a conscious recognition that this is a complex dilemma that President Bush knew as well, and President Obama does, that requires a complex solution. But and as a result, he's listening to all different perspectives. Nothing's off the table, which I think is important. There has been some movement towards what I'm talking about, as you saw as an AP story last week or a week ago, saying that there was talk about creating a hybrid system, which sounds eerily familiar, on military base at Fort Leavenworth or up in Michigan or somewhere, where they would have a hybrid system. What they're calling for now is, or was arguably leaked or put out, was they'd go into the system and they would either be sent either to an Article III court, civilian court system, or into a military commission system. My fear with that is it is hybrid, but it should go the next step by having the dual venue and that bifurcated process. That's going to create legitimacy issues. If you have one system, one court system that balances both of those two paradigms, that's the best way to move this forward and to ensure that we both uphold the rule of law and still protect the national security.
Glenn Psalmasi, his book is The National Security Court System. It's just out from Oxford University Press. Glenn, I thank you so much for being with us.
Jeff, thanks very much for having me on.